From the ashes of disaster grow the roses of success. That great, timeless, motivational quote from the inspirational source, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That's what we're told. Embrace failure. Use it. Build on it. Out of failure comes success. How can you succeed if you haven't failed? But hang on a minute. Aren't we also told, never let your little darlings fail. Don't even let them get a whiff of disappointment. It may tinker with their precious little self-esteems. We're talking about failure today. My guests are the sports writer Jim White, whose most recent book is about children and sport, Amanda Platel, William Hague's press secretary during the landslide election loss in 2001, a journalist with high-profile sackings to her name, but first a man who's made a success out of failure, or rather a career out of it. John Otway, a singer-songwriter from Aylesbury, is most famous for the songs Core Baby That's Really Free and Beware of the Flowers Because I'm Sure They're Gonna Get You, Yeah. There wasn't much before or since, but his tours with Wild Willie Barrett are renowned for their energy and the likelihood of physical injury occurring to one or the other. And asked what he wanted for his 50th birthday, he replied, a second hit. John Otway, tell us about your life of failure.
Right. In 1987, I'd reached a particularly low point in my life and chose that point to write an autobiography. I thought the story would work well as it had a proper beginning, middle and end. A pop star that started out as a dustman, had a hit record and nearly ended up as a dustman again. Many rock autobiographies tend to tell the story of the battle between, you know, the sensitive, creative artist and the insensitive, incompetent and greedy music business. But I thought it'd be fun to write my book taking the opposite view, with the artist having, you know, the uncanny ability to turn any promising situation to both their own and everyone else's disadvantage. At my first meeting with my publisher, I was informed how my book was going to be marketed. Rock and roll's greatest failure. John Otway's hilarious but moving account on his insane assault on the music industry. A tale of blind ambition and rank incompetence. Promoting myself as rock and roll's greatest failure did actually turn my career around. I got more media exposure than ever before. I mean, a lot of TV and radio, and a whole page in the Daily Mirror headlined, What a Prat I Am. Right? And the T-shirts were good too. John Otway, One Hit Wonder. John Otway, The Hitless Years. It's nearly rock and roll, but I like it. And John Otway, I Can't Believe It's Not Better. Right? And I wasn't worried, because I felt that as my career improved, there would come a point when the failed tag would just become inappropriate. And my career did improve. And they did come upon, and I felt the failure tag was inappropriate. Over the years, I had a solid fan base, and that resulted in selling out the Astoria for my 2000th gig, packing out the Albert Hall, and voting my song Beware of the Flowers Because I'm Sure They're Going to Get You, Yeah, to be the nation's seventh favourite lyric in 2000 years. And then, incredibly, I actually got back on top of the pops with a top 10 hit for my 50th birthday. Now, I thought, now the failure tag is well and truly buried, and it could have been if I'd have followed the wise advice I'd been given, you know, every time I'd had a hit, you know, don't let it go to your head. With my big hit record, I felt I was now so successful that anything was possible. I put down the deposit on a jet airliner with Otair on the tail and sold tickets to the fans for circumnavigational world tour that would take in Carnegie Hall, Sydney Opera House and a total eclipse of the sun. So I'm now starting to write my second autobiography, John Otway, Rock and Roll's Greatest Failure, Part 2, the climax of which is losing £160,000 on this world tour, which consisted of one date in the Cavern in Liverpool, while a whole audience had very recently been immunised against an array of tropical diseases.
That was John Otway. John, you're very bullish about the business of failure. Are you a failure? Do you think of yourself as a failure?
No, I actually genuinely thought I was a huge, huge success when I had the top 10 hit record for my 50th birthday, and that's where it all started going wrong.
But John, didn't you ever think you might succeed? I mean, didn't you kind of feel as though you put your mark down very, very early to be a failure? Didn't you want to try and write some more hits?
Well, I did. I just thought when I wrote the first book, what I was going to be was the phoenix rising out of the ashes. Well, actually, have the phoenix rose out of the ashes and plummeted its way back into the fire.
But were you really trying through all that time, 30 years, 1977 it started, were you been trying to succeed all that time? Or did there come a point when you thought, there's more money in being seen as a failure?
No, there was just not the option at the time. At the time when I wrote the first book, I could really hardly write about being a huge, huge pop star, as soon as I'm basically homeless and penniless. So it was an amusing book about where I'd messed up.
But you clearly don't think you're a loser, do you?
Well, the new album out, actually, is John Otway, the patron saint of losers.
Well, you got the plug in there, John, so can't be that bad. But I saw you, sorry, I don't wish to age you by saying that I saw you in my youth, but I did. I saw you playing with Wild Willie Barrett, and there was always an edge of failure, even then, I felt, that you were not setting yourself up as a grand outfit. You were very self-effacing, even back then in the punk days, weren't you?
I didn't really have any choice apart, you know, there wasn't a great deal of talent there, so half the fun was to actually just go up and be this sort of thing on stage that the audience would watch, I think, and think, oh, I could do that.
Hey, but you are seen now as a very kind of, as a lovable musician, pop star, and this is part of our culture, isn't it, that we like this kind of failure. There's something kind of heroic about it. There's something magnificent about your kind of failure. Jim, what do you think?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the comedy figures of our time, none of them are successes. You know, if you look at people, you know, everything from Captain Mannering through Basil Fawlty through to The Office, you know, The Thick of It, everything is about failure. But what the difference with John is that he senses that he's a failure. I think a lot of these comedy characters never quite realised how hopeless they were.
I think a lot counts, and I think that's probably what you've done, John, a lot counts when you've completely failed. And the way you conduct yourself after that and what you do with those ashes. You may not rise out of them, but you may just kind of rearrange them into a little barbecue and you know, and get going again.
Well, absolutely. I mean,
as a chef.
I did think about trying to write something about my career when I had the second hit, but it just wasn't funny. It just sounded like showing off.
we'll talk more about writing from the ashes a bit later, but I just want to pursue this about what we like about failure. I mean, you mentioned the comedy figures, but what is it about failure that the British appear to quite like? What's endearing about it?
Well, I think, you know, we always characterise the German sense of humour about laughing at other people's misfortune. But since most of us can characterise our lives in one way or another as a failure, I mean, very few people would imagine themselves as a success. I'm sure if you spoke to Brad Pitt, he would think he wasn't as successful as he might like to be. I think most of us are failed in one way or another. Some of us failed in more ways than others. And I think we see, thank God there's someone else out there, and we find a kind of human sympathy with them.
There's a really key thing that we only like people to fail so much. We don't like them being humiliated.
I mean, the funniest thing that's been written in 20 years on British TV is the final episode of The Office, where, of course, the Ricky Gervais character actually gets some sort of sympathetic denouement, doesn't he? We all think, oh, he's done all right out of it. You're right. We're not like the Germans. We don't want them to fall off the roof and break both legs. We want to fall off the roof and twist their ankle, but get up and walk away afterwards.
But with celebrity, isn't there part of the celebrity story always that the next chapter or the one after that is going to be one of failure? You were a success for a while in our culture, and the next chapter somehow is failure. We're looking for them to fall off the perch sometime. John?
Well, possibly. I'm hoping that by pushing failure forward, everybody goes, well, the next chapter's going to be success.
We want him up on that perch. Yes.
The whole publishing industry is now predicated on failure. If you look at the celebrity publishing industry at the moment, you go into a bookshop, it's full of stories from people like Kerry Katona and so on about how they have failed. And they actually present themselves as failure and are making a great career out of it. Not, I have to say, as attractive a career as John Otway has made out of failure, but there are lots of people making plenty of money out of the fact that they have fallen from the perch.
Well, let's talk more about what failure is then, because if they're making plenty of money, it's obviously not wealth that is a measurement of it. Can we define failure? Is it just failing to achieve something that you've set yourself or that the world has set for you? What is it?
Well, I think there is, obviously, there's a portion of it is about self-esteem and about self-judgment and so on. But I think there's also expected levels from society wider. I mean, Amanda, you work for William Hague. I mean, dismissed a man still in his 30s with so much possibility and so much judgment that he could lend. But we're very, very quick to dismiss him. So I think there are two sides to it. And I think as a society, we're much quicker than perhaps we are as individuals to note what failure is.
Let's introduce Amanda Platel more fully. She's a journalist, once press secretary for William Hague. When he lost the 2001 general election in a second landslide defeat, he quit, and so did Amanda Platel. The party wasn't very pleased when a secret video diary she'd recorded during the campaign turned up on Channel 4 television. Amanda's had other setbacks in her career. She was sacked as editor of the Sunday Express following publication of details of Peter Mandelson's relationship with a Brazilian man. It wasn't the first time she was sacked, and it may not be the last, but she keeps on bouncing back. Amanda, read us what you've written.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce you to our guest speaker, Amanda Platel, one of the most successful journalists of her generation. The problem was, no one walked onto that stage. Another speaker on the panel elbowed me as I sat dumbfounded at the description of my life. And the reason I hesitated was I thought they were describing somebody else. The eulogy did not capture my life. Yes, I've done well. Yes, I've had some great jobs. But where are all the sackings? Where are all the disappointments? Where are all the times I've been passed over because I was A, a foreigner, B, a woman, or C, I just screwed up? In short, where were the failures? Because I don't recognise myself without them. I'd been knocked down and squashed more times than a temporary roadwork sign on the M1. I've been sacked by the best, I've been sacked by the worst. I've bravely spat in the face of defeat and had a tornado spat back at me. Crikey, I fought the 2001 general election with William Hague and won one seat. They say that in life what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I'm not sure that's true. It just gives you another go, if you've got the guts to take it. Another chance with the wisdom of failure under your belt. It's what you do with failure that counts. And failures hit you in different ways. I mean, the failure of my marriage didn't put me off men or marriage. It made me stronger and more determined never again to be lashed to the mast of another's ship and to never again have a joint bank account. What is it, a failure? I couldn't have the kids I longed for. I had every operation and tried every reasonable thing medical science had to offer. Having a child was just not in the hand that God decided to deal me. It was a huge loss to my life, but what more could I have done? I think that's the secret of failure. The only real failure is when you haven't tried, when you've been knocked down again and again and don't get back up on your feet. If you try and don't succeed, if you really, really try and know you couldn't have done it any better, that's not a failure. But in our society, we airbrush out inconvenient truths. We have a modern vocabulary of failure words we don't use, like sacked and abandoned and lost and dumped and barren and defeated. Well, I've been sacked and abandoned and lost and dumped and barren and defeated. And apart from not having been able to have kids, I wouldn't and probably couldn't have missed out on any of them for the world.
Amanda Platel, this is Off the Page. My other two guests are John Otway and Jim White. Amanda, let's start there. That was the most striking thing, that in amongst all these sackings and firings and bouncing up and down, the one thing that really strikes me is your inability to have children has been the thing that's affected you most. Do you think of it as a failure in any way?
I thank God, really, in a way, that I didn't ever do any of the things, you know, that I didn't have any sexually transmitted diseases, that I had never had an abortion. I'd never done any of those things, that, and that I didn't leave it really late to decide to try and start a family. I think that makes it much harder for a woman. We all have our tick boxes. On that level, I did try every operation. You know, I did go through everything that was out there. I sat through, you know, the interviews with IVF people who would say things like, well, you know, you have a 1.5% chance, and you go, 1.5%, you know, that's heartbreaking. That's life changing. But it's not a failure. I couldn't have, you know, I couldn't have tried any harder. I couldn't have wanted it anymore.
But have you sensed that other people think you're a failure as a result of that?
I wouldn't use the word failure, but I think that there are some people who do judge women especially. I don't think they'd look at a man and say, oh, there's, you know, there's a 50-year-old man, he's never had children, he's a failure. But I do think they look at you and they think, ah, she's missing out on something. I think one of the things that I And of course I'm missing out on something. You know?
Do you think that's changing? I mean, I can see that that was the case 20 years ago, but don't you think people are now more accepting of women who have a good job and don't want that in their lives?
But you see, that's not the case with me, is it? And I suppose if there's one thing I think I've failed at, it's at allowing people to just assume, because I had at times a glittering career, that meant that I'd chosen not to have children. That was, I mind the assumptions people make about me. And I mind the fact that perhaps I wasn't honest enough in the beginning with people so that they could see me in the round. So I failed to let people know the kind of person I was, that they made those judgments about me.
And John Otway, what do you think of this idea that society in general does make judgments about people? If it is that a woman's job is to have a child, whatever else she does, that's considered
a failure. I can't see how you can regard something that is outside your scope of influence as a failure. If you can't influence something, it's not a success or failure thing.
But some people insist. Some people do look at you. Funnily enough, it is especially women who've got families, and they think, well, she's, you know, God, she hasn't got kids. What kind of a life's that? They think that your life is not full. It's not, and therefore it has failed on any measure of what it is worthwhile. What's worthwhile to be a woman, which I think is the most terrible judgment.
Does their attitude change when you explain how hard you tried?
Yes, it does. It does, but there's still a part of them that goes away, you know, sort of hanging their heads and going, that poor old Amanda Platel, you know.
Let's move back to some other parts of your career, which we probably could say were failures. The 2001 election defeat for William Hague when you were his press secretary must have affected you pretty deeply. What memories do you have of what that did to you?
Oh, it was absolutely and abjectly devastating, in a way that even surprises me still when I think about it, because, you know, nothing could have been more predictable, but nothing quite prepares you for catastrophic defeat. It was one of the hardest times of my life after that, partly because you're just so damned exhausted as well.
Did you feel any shame?
Do you know, I didn't feel shame, because I felt that we worked as a team to an agreed agenda. What I was surprised by was the fact that I became virtually unemployable for nearly a year and had the hardest time of my working life. I mean, people just said, you know, you are tarred with failure. That's what they used to say.
Sorry, John.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to pick up on the end bit of your piece, you sort of said you wouldn't change anything. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I change loads and loads and loads. And I was very surprised that you said you wouldn't change anything. And especially when you're sort of saying how difficult it was. I mean, surely you would like to go back change that bit.
Do you know, I suppose I believe in a kind of a natural course of life and a form of destiny.
Well, let's move on to Jim White and introduce him a bit more fully. Jim writes on sport for the Daily Telegraph, presents Scottish television's Champions League coverage, and is film critic of Word magazine. He's written and presented several television documentaries, including an examination of Jose Mourinho, the Jose Mourinho phenomenon. He's also published several books about football, most recently You'll Win Nothing with Kids, Fathers, Sons and Football, about his experiences as a boys' football team coach, serialised here on Radio 4. Jim, what have you written?
Well, we lost again on Sunday. My son's youth football team, the bunch I coach, once more came second in a two-horse race. Actually, thinking about it, so badly were they beaten, they may well have come third. There were extenuating circumstances. The lads were kicked and punched and stamped on by a gang of thugs clearly auditioning for a mass ASBO. But there was no escaping the truth. This was failure. And it hurt. It was, however, I feel, a necessary hurt. In sport, failure is the thing you work to avoid. It's the pain of defeat, the awful gut-grinding feeling as if a chorus line of Beryl Cook characters is doing a tap dance on your abdomen that spurs you on in the pursuit of victory. Failure is what you fear. Failure is what you yearn to avoid. There is no starker demonstration of this than the annual parade of masochism that is the university boat race. The two teams from Oxford and Cambridge spend a year torturing themselves in training, then burst their lungs for 20 minutes of misery along the Thames. There is no sport so physically demanding, and what pushes them through pain is the thought of what awaits under Mortlake Bridge. Here, just past the finish line, when it's over, the two crews float in exhaustion, only a few feet apart. But that couple of yards may as well be the distance to the moon. The contrast between the occupants of the two boats could not be more extreme. One team looks utterly shattered, their gaze hollow. their arms limp, sporting colossi shrinking before our very eyes. They could not look more miserable if they'd just been given a date for their own deaths, and it's tomorrow. Alongside them, the victors whoop and slap the water, their pain forgotten. This is not triumphalism. It's relief. They're just thankful. They're not feeling like the guys in the other boat. Thus is failure a vital ingredient in sport, as vital as victory. What's the point of triumph if you've never experienced its evil twin? Even Roger Federer and Tiger Woods occasionally lose, and it hurts them so much they work doubly hard to keep its stinging rebuke at bay. And this is the real importance of sporting failure, especially for the young. Without wishing to sound too much like a middle-aged newspaper columnist, children in these materialistic days generally get what they want. They merely have to express a desire for a PlayStation or a mini motorbike, and it's theirs. Even the exam system encourages those who didn't get the grades they wanted to have their papers remarked until they do. Only in sport is merely wanting not enough. Only in sport is the return for application and effort so quantifiable. And failure is the spur, the driver, the engine of that endeavour. Not, it has to be said, that it has worked sufficiently for my son's football team yet, but when that elusive victory comes, boy, will we be ready to celebrate.
Jim White, the losing age in the boat race, isn't that a bit of an overreaction? I mean, it's only a game, isn't it? The game's the thing.
I think for those guys, they've spent a year targeting this particular event. They've spent a year of putting their bodies through absolute torture. It's horrible what they do to themselves. So I think for them, in that moment, yeah, they may recover 6 months later, but at that time, they couldn't feel worse.
John Otway, what do you think? I mean, is it something they should just get over?
I've often wondered, those people that do the penalty shoot, kicks in, like the World Cup, that the whole country is behind them, whether somebody ever recovers from coming home after missing one of those. Well, I mean, do you know? I mean,
actually, interesting that, because at the last World Cup, 2006, when England lost on penalties, the last person to miss was Frank Lampard, and as I was coming out of the ground, the kind of everyone was saying, "Oh, Frank Lampard, he's let us down, he's destroyed us, he's hopeless, he's disgraceful." And as I was walking towards the media bus, I saw his father coming in the opposite direction, and I didn't say anything to him, but I just caught his eye, and I could see in his eye, you know, this real kind of sense of failure on his son's behalf. You know, he really was feeling for him. You could see it. And I think it takes an awful long time.
John Otway, you wrote a song called A413 Revisited, and that's about a particular failure of yours. But tell us what it is and what the consequences of it were.
No, it was the 11 plus, I mean, which I just think is such an awful, unfair, you know, exam. And I just wrote the line, you know, if at first you don't succeed, you've already been a failure once. Just that tagging of kids at 11. And some of them go off to one school and some of them go off to another. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about it at 11. And you don't realise before you take the exam what huge consequences it is.
Well, don't you also think that there's a sense that that having failures like that actually do give you the opportunity to kind of grow, to get that fight within you? I mean, I can remember at the end of my school days, when I was 11 years old, I thought I'd won the overall athletics championship trophy. I was presented it in front of the whole school. Absolutely glorious moment. Ran up to my mum and dad, big kisses. Got back to school on Monday. They said, "We added it up wrongly. You didn't win," and took it off me in front of... And, yes. You wonder what made me the person I am. I took it off me and said, "We're sorry, this other girl deserved it, and Mandy Platel didn't." And I'm sure, God, crikey, it stung, but, you know, I'm sure that taught me something. It taught me how important it was to keep the cup.
John, what about you?
No, but that certainly doesn't work with the 11 plus. What it teaches with 11 plus is gone are your chance of ever being a doctor, gone are your chance of going to Oxford and Cambridge, gone a lot of doors have suddenly slammed shut on you at the age of 11 on one exam.
11 was an awful system, and partly because there was no recovery from it. You know, you couldn't at 13 then take an exam to get back into the grammar school system. It was, you were written off. You were doing woodwork while they were doing French. You know, it was just as simple and stark as that. And actually, I think that's the usefulness of sport. I know, Amanda, you had a miserable experience, but I think that's the usefulness of sport, because you can put all of that into something that ultimately doesn't matter.
But you don't now, if you're children, do you? You get given non-competitive sports days, you get beanbag races and games called Stranded Sheep instead of the 100 metres.
But this is because of a kind of reaction the other way, that we all, I think, acknowledge how cruel the 11 plus would be. And now that there's a prevailing thought in education that nobody should fail.
And what do you think of that?
Well, I don't think it works. I don't think you can, because I think, as all of us around this table know, ultimately, we're going to have to face failure. Nobody goes through life succeeding. Everyone's going to have to face failure. And actually, I think sport is a good place to learn those things, because ultimately it doesn't matter.
I just completely and utterly agree with that. And you know, there has to be competition. I think also the good thing about having sport being truly competitive is it gives your parents the opportunities to, you know, not shove you, but to kind of encourage you and say, you know, you're never going to, the great lesson, you know, what is that wonderful golfing expression, that the more I practice, the luckier I get. That has to be my view of life, of writing columns of everything I've done in terms of relationships. The more I try, the harder I work at things, the more I try and learn from my mistakes, you know, the better I get. And there are a lot of great lessons to be learned from sport.
Well, let's bring Chitty Chitty Bang Bang back into this whole thing. I mean, try again. If at first you don't succeed, dust yourself off, pick yourself up. It's what you do with failure, isn't it, that's important. You can take the knock if you're gonna learn from it.
Yes, and it does, I mean, it does make you stronger. It doesn't, it's not very often that these things kill you, like your boat race, Jim, you know. I mean, it kills you for a bit, but then you do build something from it. And I often think that when you look around you, certainly the most interesting people and often the most successful people are the ones who've had knocks and they've been able to get back up off their knees.
Maybe we should end with a thought from Thomas Edison. I have not failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work. Is that a good way of looking at these kind of knocks that we take?
Sums me up.
I think that's a perfect attitude. I'd endorse that completely.
Actually, my boys, it's more than 10,000 ways they generally find to lose.
Well, let's end on that note, and perhaps another quote from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Every bursted bubble has a glory. Each abysmal failure makes a point. Every glowing path that goes astray shows you how to find a better way. We've heard from Thomas Edison. My guests have been Amanda Platel, John Otway, and Jim White. I'm Dominic Arkwright. Goodbye.